Hi, you're listening to the Peaches Aren't the Only Fruit podcast, a podcast in which we discuss the A League of Their Own TV show on Amazon Prime. I'm Karen, and with me today is Emma, and you can find us on social media at PATOF Podcast. Emma, before we start, gut reaction to this episode.
I really enjoyed this episode. I thought there were some funny jokes. I loved seeing the Gretzen storyline move forward. But I have to admit, there were a couple things in the episode that I felt really disappointed by and a little bit let down with the buildup up to this point. So I'm looking forward to discussing that with you and seeing what your take was on that. What was your overall feeling about this episode?
You know, I'm right there with you. There were parts of it I loved, and there are parts of it that, you know what, I think could have been done a little bit differently. And I think we're going to leave that right there and keep our listeners interested to find out what it is we didn't like. So Emma, before we go any further, I need you to give us a 2-minute or less summary of what happened in this episode.
Okay, I hope you're timing. I'm going to try to do this. So episode 4, the Peaches are finally starting to up their game as Carson comes into her own as the unofficial coach. Things are also getting hot and heavy between Greta and Carson. They become roommates on a trip and have a very steamy love scene in the convent where they're spending the night. Max is making good money at the factory, $25 per paycheck. She recruits Clance, who isn't making nearly that much at her job, but Max's baseball hopes fall flat. I think that's a pretty quick summary. I think I got it well under the 2 minutes.
You did. You got it in about 33 seconds.
Oh, okay. Well, if you can say it in a more succinct way, then go for it.
Absolutely. So let's dive into it.
The first thing I think we should talk about would be Gretzen. This was a big Gretzen episode. Obviously, everyone on social media, in the fandoms, AO3 loves Gretzen. I was so excited to see this. But, ooh, I don't know. What did you think about it?
You know what? Like last episode, I think we're going to have to break it down scene by scene to really go through this. Now, I think we need to remember that when episode 3 ended, Carson gets off the phone with Charlie and is empowered or invigorated to go after what she wants. And what she wants is Greta. And so when this episode starts, by the way, did anyone catch that intro where we have Shirley playing the flute and Lupe putting on makeup on the field, all of those things? That is a callback to the original A League of Their Own movie.
Oh, I had no idea, really?
Yes, and I only know that because my girlfriend told me. Don't judge me, but that's what that was. Right after we move away from that little montage, we get Gretzen again. They're making out everywhere. They're in the basement. They're in the forest. It's hilarious, and I love it. I love this montage. One of my favorite lines in the episode, they're making out under the tree, an owl hoots, and Greta's like, "What's that?" And Kristen says, "I think it's probably just some owl whose tree we're against." Damn it! That's just my favorite. It's that, damn it. I just love that.
Yeah, you really finally get to see the payoff where they're just all over each other. And Carson is like, "Hey, I really want to be with you."
And that leads us to the next scene. They have, having been scared out of the forest by an owl. I love that we see that Carson wants to move their relationship to the next level. We have this idea of, I don't just want to make out. I want to have sex. I love this idea of the celebration of female desire, this affirmation of Carson's desire to explore her sexuality. I'm really, really glad they put that scene in there because I think it's a really great scene. And I think it's something that maybe a heterosexual male screenwriter wouldn't have thought to put in there.
I agree. You really get the sense that Carson is wanting to take charge of her sexuality, that she's exploring things and excited about it. And I think especially at that time, but really in a lot of portrayals of women and other not cishet men type characters, sometimes it can feel like, oh, their desires are an accessory rather than they're leading the charge and not just something that's complementary to a man.
Right. And they're not just falling into bed in an act of passion. This is something that Carson has really thought about. This has been on her mind.
Yeah.
So I want to go to the next.
I'm just so excited to get to the point where, like, finally things happen. But okay, I'm going to have
But we're not there yet.
I know.
It's a total cookie dangle, isn't it? Carson engineers this wonderful moment on the bus where she manipulates Shirley and finally finagles her way into her room with Greta. And it's wonderful. Again, these are the scenes that really make this show pop. this is what gives the show sparkle to me.
Yeah, I thought it was really funny. And that was one of those exciting parts, again, because it's the buildup to like, oh, the big, they're going to be alone together finally and have privacy.
And then, dun, 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 we don't get the payoff. Because what we get is Carson pushing Greta to the bed, going for it. And here's the funny thing about the scene that follows. Listeners probably don't know that both you and I write fan fiction, and I have two fan fictions about A League of Their Own up on Archive of Our Own. And in order to write my first fan fiction from Carson's point of view, from the point of view of this scene, I had to watch this scene like probably 20 times. I mean, it was like pitch black. I had headphones in and I was stopping every second or second and a half, rewinding, listening again, because the scene is actually so short. And it just goes by like the snap of your fingers. What we see is that Carson, she wants everything to be perfect, almost in that way that as a teenager, you kind of want things to be perfect and this is going to be great and I've fantasized about this. And then things aren't going great. Greta touches her butt and instead of enjoying the feeling and leaning into it, she jumps away. But then for the listener, for the watcher, it kind of becomes jumbled. I wish they'd slowed this scene down, because it was only after like the fifth time of amping up the volume and listening and thin slicing the scene, I could actually understand what Carson was saying in that moment.
Yeah, and I realized how fast the scene was when I was doing my rewatch, because I stepped away to get a cup of water or something. Like I stepped away what I thought was for like 2 seconds. And when I came back, it was over. And I was like, wait, how did I just miss the whole big payoff scene of their romance? It made me realize, wow, that was so short. And the parts where you see them together, even though they're so memed and they're so highlighted on the internet, you just realize watching it again, it actually was a very short scene.
Yeah, I think when you have a big ensemble like this and you're telling a bigger story, and in some ways, this show is telling two stories. It's got double the work because we have Carson's world and we have Max's world. Every scene has to land. Every scene has to pack a punch. And so the scene becomes really memorable. As you say, it becomes this 3-second GIF that gets circulated on Twitter. But if you stitch together all of the scenes, I would bet all of the Carson Greta scenes probably only come to about 6 minutes. And it's something that I want us to talk about later when we have part two of this scene. In essence, we want more. As an audience, we have such little material to work with. I don't want to say such little representation, but such little representation of female intimacy and these moments that when it only lasts 3 seconds, it's like we're some plant in the desert that got a single drop of rain and we want to blossom and we want to suck up that water, but then there's no more drops of rain.
Something I want to talk about more would be the role of fan fiction and how you feel like that fills in gaps where things aren't shown on screen. Because yeah, this has a really big fandom following. We both looked over some of the fics in this fandom and people are really hungry to see that relationship played out. So what do you think fandom does and fics do when things aren't shown on screen?
I think one of the reasons that there is so much erotica in fan fiction is because that's something that often isn't on screen. Now, we can all understand if it's a non-canonical couple, like, of course, it's not on screen. But even if it's a canonical couple, people tend to be writing the sex scenes because these aren't the things that you see. What I did for my fan fiction, just to use that as an example, and for anyone that's wondering what the title was, it's The Things You Do to Me.
I haven't read your fanfic yet, but I'm excited now.
Oh my gosh, Emma, I hope you like it. The idea is that we see one aspect of a scene, and as the viewer, we make inferences about what's happening. We look at the actress's face and we infer that the character is feeling a certain way. But the difference between seeing something on screen and reading it on the page is that when an author is writing a scene, they can bring a lot more into it. You get a lot more of the emotions. You can have a character thinking back, oh, this reminds me of the time 5 years ago. Or they can be thinking, oh my God, my bra is like, I didn't wash it, right? Like these things that might not appear on screen, and it provides greater depth. But you can also write scenes to be longer. You can write scenes that weren't there. It's kind of like the show becomes the skeleton and then the fan fiction writers can fill in whatever part they want. It becomes a structural framework on which people can build ideas. I love that about fan fiction. I know that sometimes among writers, there is this weird, almost like chauvinism, where it's like, oh my God, you're a fan fiction writer. But actually, in the lesbian fiction community, a lot of the lesbian fiction writers not only wrote fan fiction before they became published, but continue to write fan fiction. So it becomes kind of a playground on which they can play and play with ideas. And I think what writers love to do is really explore the interpersonal dynamics in a way that there's just not time to do on screen.
I'll admit, I was one of those people before I knew a lot about fan fiction who thought, oh, this is like something weird, or this is Twilight. I mean, I've never seen Twilight and that series.
Emma, I just want to interrupt you here. I've seen the first movie like at least 10 times because it is a wonderful comedy. If you just take it as a comedy, it's fantastic.
Okay, that's how I'll have to watch it. Or 50 Shades of Grey, was that the one that was a fan fiction?
It was, and I think that's the thing. E.L. James is so rich now. I can't even be mad about that.
You know, those were my only senses of fan fiction. But as I started to look more into it, I realized again what we were talking about, how people fill in the gaps for what's not shown, and particularly going back to that sense of female desire or things that just are not typically in the framework of mainstream media, of showing people who do not fit a certain mold, that they have desire, that they can be desired, even though they don't fit the parameters of what a lot of mainstream writing or what gets greenlighted on big television networks. I've read some fan fiction where I'm like, this writing is just very good. And people don't know, professionally, I'm an editor. That's my regular job. And I mean, some of the writing is very technically good. The storytelling is very rich. It's like anything else where you come across things that you don't really like or things that just aren't that interesting. But some of the work out there is great. And so I tip my hat to the fan fiction writers in this fandom in particular. Going back to what was shown on screen, I really wish they had done more because it is such a nice scene. And I think the relationship between Greta and Carson, they're building up to it. The actors have such warmth between them. You can tell that they're comfortable with each other. Again, it's this line where I said earlier in the podcast, I don't like things feeling so explicit and like they're exploiting people. It's not that I thought they needed to do full nudity or something like that, but I think they could have built in more sensuality, made it slower, longer. Like you said, if they had the characters slow down their speaking and just linger on some of the shots, I'm sure that they had to make cuts for time, but I think that would have made it feel like more of that peak in the story.
Emma, let's come back to that when we actually get the consummation. But before we move to the next Gretson scene, I do want to say one more thing about fanfiction, because you write AU fanfiction sometimes. And when I first started reading fanfiction, I didn't understand AU. Why would someone be writing AU when there's so much material to be covered that's not AU? But in fact, I think there's a lot to be done there. And I think it is wonderful to take these characters and their dynamics and stick them in a new context.
So I actually think that Carson and Greta really lend themselves to AUs because they're characters who are clearly not totally of their era. As we've discussed before, the writing of the show doesn't make it feel like it's intended to be 100% reflective of attitudes and characters who would be in the 1940s. So I think they're an example of people who'd be great to drop into other scenarios, if it's being in a school, if it's being in modern day, those types of things, and maintain the characters' personalities and traits, but see what they're like in a different setting. To me, that's one of the most fun things about fan fiction. It's taking characters that you love and putting them in different types of scenarios that were not able to be explored on screen. And again, a lot of it, I think, is giving them happy endings that these characters very often don't get.
That's fair. So let's move on, because the next Gretson scene doesn't end up being the time they actually have sex, is it? Greta has said, let's take a moment. Let's step back. Let's make you more comfortable, Carson. And so the next time we see them, Carson is chowing down on a sausage, which we have to admit is rather phallic and is kind of a weird choice.
I didn't even notice that. It was a sausage?
Yes, because Greta says something about sausage, and I'm pretty sure Carson kind of like waggles it or something. It's like every lesbian thing. There's a sausage, there's a carrot. I don't know. I don't know what's going on. And by the way, that carrot reference is to Ammonite. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, never see that movie. Save yourself
the pain. I have no idea what you're talking about, so I'm feeling thankful.
I don't know who was like, you know, it'd be amazing. A movie about a grumpy fossil collector in a very dreary English town in the 1800s. I don't care if you put Kate Winslet in it and Saoirse Ronan. It doesn't make it any more interesting.
All right. Well, I will not see it then. People don't know you're a real movie buff, and I take your recommendations very seriously.
I try and keep up with the lesbian movies, and there are so few of them that it's relatively easy to do. If anyone is listening that wants recommendations, hit us up on Twitter, because I'm happy to put them on there. And I think there are good queer female movies that are on some of the streaming services, but actually it's a really small number right now. So when we see something like Ammonite, which must have been made for millions of dollars, it was Oscar bait, to be such a disappointing movie. It's when things like that happen that Hollywood says, why would we make movies for lesbians? They don't sell. Well, don't make Ammonite. And another movie that is currently on streaming, it's on Hulu right now, is The World to Come. It could have been an amazing movie. It's the equivalent of Brokeback Mountain. It's kind of that Western-y, old-timey vibe. And the ending just kills it. It's one of those things where they completely misread the room. This is decades on from Brokeback Mountain. The times have changed, and audiences that are watching this type of movie, because there's such a limited audience anyway, if you have an unhappy ending, we're just going to burn the theater down and show up with pitchforks.
Karen, I'm going to admit something. I've never seen Brokeback Mountain.
It was a good movie, but to bring it back to A League of Their Own, at least with A League of Their Own, and we've talked about this before, this idea of queer joy, there's always that hope aspect, the idea that society hasn't yet crushed this relationship, and there's hope that maybe it never will be able to.
Something else that this makes me think about is streaming services. That's a big game changer, the way that it's introduced so many more stories rather than you just have to have $20 million to make a big blockbuster type film. I think that's somewhere that stories are able to reach different audiences now because there are different ways to disseminate these stories. There are different people who can see them who aren't just the people who go to the theater or the people who have a certain cable package that has that channel on it. It's a lot easier to just get whatever one of the streaming services and then have access to hundreds and thousands of films and TV shows. A topic that I'm sure we could talk about a lot is the content on there and feeling like there's so much available but nothing to watch.
Oh my God. Emma, it's not that there's nothing to watch. My queue has like 130 movies. I just happen to not want to watch the movies that I want to watch. But I want to take something that you said, and then I want us to come back to A League of Their Own. People were unhappy this year because they felt that a lot of queer female-fronted shows had been canceled. And that was true in the sense that The Wilds was canceled and Gentleman Jack and just a whole bunch of TV shows. And many people felt that it, in essence, unfairly targeting as this discriminatory towards queer female representation. My response to that is, of course, there's going to be a lot of factors. Sure, some of it could come into play. I think the First Kill Heartstopper comparison is a really interesting one because by all metrics, First Kill appears to have outperformed Heartstopper, but Heartstopper got renewed for 2 seasons while First Kill was canceled. But we also have to recognize that there's more queer female representation than any other time. So maybe in the past you had 2 shows that had queer female leads and both got canceled. You'd be like, ah, that's our 2 shows. Now you could have 10 queer female fronted shows. And if half got canceled, you still have 5 remaining. And now you're just in line with regular statistics of show cancellations. It doesn't have to be a LGBT issue. Yes, we lost Gentleman Jack and we lost The Wilds, but we got Warrior Nun in season 2. We have all of these shows now. And I think that's something that we forget. It's like, we want A League of Their Own to be renewed. But if it's not renewed, that could also just be a reflection on Amazon just spent $500 million making its Lord of the Rings show, season 1.
I haven't watched that either.
I have not either. But you know what? They kind of have less money than they used to if they spend $500 million on that, right? Just because a show is canceled doesn't mean it's because it was queer female. And it doesn't mean that either another pre-existing show or a new show won't have representation. So it's just something to keep in mind. I think there's a lot of people out there that want to take a metrics-based approach. But the problem is a lot of the streamers don't give you that data. You can't figure out how many viewers there are or how many maybe viewing hours there were. Sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. So in that sense, the traditional TV networks And even some of the cable networks, you could see, oh, well, it had 500,000 viewers. That's not enough for its budget. Or it had 1 million viewers, but its budget was bigger than that. And so the cost reward factor wasn't in favor of the show. With something like League of Their Own, we just don't have that insight.
We don't know a lot about the cost to make it and the holistic cost in terms of the production, the marketing, the Amazon budget, because, I mean, I have no idea. You know, it's not a traditional media company. They have something separate. And so it could be based on the whims of where they want to take that. But that gives me hope, at least. And I hope it gives our listeners hope that since you've been particularly tracking a lot of these trends with queer, mostly queer female media, things have improved a lot. As you said, the landscape from 5, 10, 20 years ago is really different and it's better.
So Greta and Carson, the next time we see them is still not a sex scene, but the next scene is actually, it is one of the most important Gretson scenes, in my opinion. And the reason for that is because we learn something about each of these characters. On Greta's side, we learn she's had many lovers, and we also start to get the sense that Greta prefers to view this as kind of a fling, an unimportant fling. And we start to understand that might be because she's protecting herself. But we also see on Carson's side that she is falling for Greta. And Carson, and I think this is perhaps Abby's best acting, she's talking about this fear of a line, of crossing a line. I think she's talking about admitting she's in love with Greta. If she's fallen in love with Greta, how does she go back to Charlie? How is she someone who's married to a man and in love with a woman? So I think it's such a powerful scene.
I thought a lot about that scene too, and I thought that was one of the best lines in the show so far, of Carson asking kind of herself, what if she crosses this line? It also seemed to have so many potential meanings to me. It could have been about her sexuality, and this is something we discussed, of whether or not she's bisexual, whether or not she leans more toward being with a woman. But also, I thought it could reference her experiencing life outside of her small town. Going back to the very beginning, we get the sense that Carson has lived her whole life in this one place. That's where all her family is, where she got married. Greta is traveling around from the big city. And I wondered how much this also reflects Carson thinking about now that she's tasted being a baseball player, living in a different world. How can she cross the line, including with this relationship, and then eventually not just go back to being married to Charlie, but go back to living not on her farm, as we hear about, but go back to living just the life that she's had before that presumably is a life she fell into because it was what was expected of her and not what she always wanted.
Yeah, I do agree with you. And the first time I saw that scene, I did interpret the line slightly differently. Watching it again, I was thinking it's the in love with Greta thing. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of lines being crossed right now. So in that sense, I think it's a huge scene.
When I first watched the show, it was the first time I'd say I really felt a lot of empathy for Greta. There are times before where we understand that she's trying to put on a happy face even when she's struggling. But this was the first time that really broke down for me. Like, she's into Carson, but she also knows that women she's had relationships with before, they go back to their husbands. And that she presumably kind of sees herself as someone who's there and trying to enjoy her life, but that she's never able to have the sort of life and relationship that she wants. And I wish that we knew more about that. I wish that we learned more about why doesn't Greta try to find some sort of situation where she and presumably she and Joe are not just traveling around from place to place, just trying their luck wherever they land.
Yeah. I do think that there is a lot of tragedy within the character of Greta. This is the problem with dating married women or having a fling with a married woman, is it's probably going to end really poorly. You talked about the sex scene, and I just want to touch on it really briefly, only to say that I agree with you. I wish the sex scene had been longer. And something that you and I talk a lot about is the problem of gratuitousness versus furthering the plot. And I think this is one of those situations where, like we said, that plant in the desert, we just want a little bit more rain. And in this case, I'm not asking for Abby and Darcy to get naked and show a lot of skin, but for viewers that really like this idea of physical intimacy, this idea of establishing emotional connection through these acts, it would have been nice if the scene had been just a little longer. And not even necessarily in the sexual part, but even in the after snuggling. So it really would have been nice for that scene to have been, even you said 30 seconds longer. I would have loved a minute or two. And with this episode length, I think they could have just fit it in. And I think it would have been really nice.
I agree. I thought a nice callback would have been having Greta stroke Carson's hair, sort of like at the beginning when Greta gives her the haircut, or doing something to have a callback to earlier episodes when they were more in the flirtation phase, but then seeing them re-up that in this scene, now that they're finally together and we're having that big payoff.
Yeah, I love that Carson initiates. I love that she has this confidence. I love that she does a 2-second striptease. What if it had been 10 seconds and she started to unbutton Greta's shirt too? That's all I'm asking for, people. Now, next topic is one that we talk about probably more than anything else. It's Shirley. Tell me about Shirley.
This episode, I really felt uneasy about Shirley. And unfortunately, as a character, she was kind of maybe even the lowest point for me in the show. You know, Shirley's like the only character who is made to be pretty openly homophobic. And again, as we talk about with the 1940s, it's sort of unusual that we don't have more characters exploring that sort of internal homophobia that has been put on them by society, or discussing the external homophobia. Greta has made comments, as we've said before, of like, we can't look like we're queers and we need to have appearances of being straight. But Shirley's the only one we see who makes mention of this and seems to be really afraid of homosexuality. Unfortunately, the character of Shirley for me felt like she's reinforcing existing stereotypes about Jewish people and may give viewers a warped idea about Jewish culture. What was your first impression when you watched the show about Shirley?
I have always loved the Shirley character. I love the way Kate gives Shirley that comedic element, whether those lines are ad-libbed or whether those were written by someone else. I think that part was really well done. For me, Shirley is coded Asperger's. For me, it seems very strongly coded that way. The inability to read social cues, some of the characterizations of this character. And, you know, one of the things about writing a character with Asperger's, so my latest book, The Lady Adventurers Club, I gave very classic and very telltale Asperger traits. And so far, there's not been a single reader who's picked up on it. Things like this, you have to be almost part of that minority subculture to recognize it. And so I read Shirley as Asperger's, but Emma immediately reads it as Jewish.
Oh, yeah. I think that your take is more in line with what a lot of the social media takes are, at least that I've seen, particularly on Tumblr. More people interpret Shirley as having OCD, as having sensory processing issues. But yeah, to me, she read so much as a Jewish stereotype in terms of being neurotic, in terms of her mannerisms. I mean, even her name, Shirley Cohen, is very clearly Jewish. I thought this was unfortunate because the show does such a thoughtful job of talking about queer trauma, Black cultural trauma at this time. But there's really no reference to anti-Semitism. And we have to remember this is taking place in the 1940s, literally during the Holocaust. Someone like Shirley, her family probably fled Europe in the late 1800s, early 1900s, escaping ghettos where they would have been persecuted for being Jewish. And now we have in Europe, Jewish people, as well as queer people and other groups who are literally experiencing a genocide. And so to have Shirley just be talking about how her rabbi says, you know, homophobia can spread, it just seems so weird to me. That was a comment in this episode. So for a couple of reasons, the line that Shirley had said was that her rabbi said, homosexuality spreads. One day you're walking around liking men, the next day it's a lobotomy. Firstly, I thought it was strange to have her as the only Jewish character identified among other Jewish actors. The person who plays Carson, the person who plays Maybell, they're both Jewish. But by picking someone and then having, like, earlier in the makeover episode, when Shirley is evaluated for being pretty, saying, well, her face is too Semitic, you're really pigeonholing someone into, oh, this is what a Jewish person looks like, and it's impossible to be pretty because of your ethnicity, which is, like, kind of a weird commentary. Moreover, the idea that Judaism and Jewish Americans have these feelings about gay culture was really strange to me. American Judaism isn't really concerned with moral panic. Issues like premarital sex, chastity, and homosexuality, they just aren't a real focus of Judaism. And in fact, most American Jewish people are quite liberal. There's actually polling data on this from Pew that finds that more than 70% of Jewish Americans are Democrats or independents who lean toward the Democratic Party. Jewish Americans tend to be overwhelmingly supportive of gay marriage and accepting of queer people.
So, Emma, do you think this is a mistake in the sense that Maybell ends up being the one who, when she finds out about Greta and Carson, she's quietly supportive, like, woo, go get him. Maybe, in fact, that supportive character should have been Shirley instead.
Yeah, I think it would have been more in line if you had made, like, if Maybell was named Shirley Cohen, things would have read very differently. And if Shirley Cohen was just Shirley Smith, that would have been really different. Because, yeah, I mean, both anecdotally from my personal experience, coming from a Jewish family, from friends of mine. Again, even if you go to the Human Rights Campaign, look up views among Reform Judaism. And at this time, you know, there are different sects of Judaism, but it's much less diverse than Christianity because it's just a much smaller group of people. 2% of the U.S. population is Jewish. It's a really small group of people. But among the leading sects, Reform Judaism, which is pretty liberal, not very observant, is sort of the main group. Even in the 1970s, the Central Conference of American Rabbis called for legislation decriminalizing homosexual acts and prohibiting discrimination against them.
I mean, that's pretty huge, isn't it, Emma?
Yeah.
I mean, when we talk about this show, and we know that this show has gone in and mined history to ensure that things that were being said are historically accurate, so much care was given to Black history and queer female history. It's a weird omission that they created what to you is a very one, maybe two-dimensional stereotyped caricature of a Jewish person.
I really did feel like, for example, Shirley's anxiety, her referencing of death, her fears about things, it's not explored. It's just sort of played as humor. And I mean, the actor is hilarious. Like the acting itself is great, but there's no exploration of like, hey, there's a literal genocide going on in Europe right at this time. And calling out that someone's look is too Jewish. Stuff like that is actually how people ended up being killed. Sort of like how people being called out for seeming queer also could put people in danger. And so I did think it was a misstep to not explore, like, why does Shirley have this anxiety? And also to just have her being the homophobic person, not that there aren't people who are Jewish who are homophobic, but as a group, it's pretty well supported that it tends to be a more open-minded, progressive group. You know, when you look at who's leading, even today, the legislation on anti-gay marriage, removing rights for trans people, the mainstream Jewish groups are not leading that stuff. They historically were more involved in advocating for civil rights for Black Americans, for queer Americans. So yeah, it felt really weird to me. And I felt like Shirley wasn't given a ton of positive and redeeming characteristics either.
You know, Emma, that's a really great segue into talking about Max. And the way I'm going to frame this is I just finished a book about screenwriting called Save the Cat. And it's really accessible to anyone like me who's never been to Hollywood, doesn't know anything about it. But it describes in very simple ways how to write a story that will work well on screen. One of the things that I took away from it is you have the central point, right? Your midpoint of your story, in which you have either a false triumph or a false defeat. And this is an episode where Carson has a false triumph in the sense that she thinks she's got the girl, and Max has a false defeat, and we'll talk about how she fails her tryout. But one of the other things that the book talks about is that your characters should undergo growth throughout your movie, or in this case, your TV show. Every character should have some start point and some end point. We see that with Lupe. We see it with a lot of the characters. Shirley, not so much. Shirley's is very ham-fisted in the sense that she just kind of wakes up one day. She's like, oh, it's fine to be gay now. But I want to talk about Max because one of the things for me, I'm not sure Max grows enough in season one for me. What do you think about that?
When I first watched the show, I really liked Max. But when I did my rewatch, as we were preparing for the podcast, I started to develop a different opinion. Kind of like with Shirley, I wanted to see more from her in terms of that internal growth and exploration of why she behaves as she behaves. I mean, we do see with Max certainly more backstory. We get to know her family, but I feel like she is kind of immature at times. And when I did my rewatch, I started to see that more and more and feel less empathy for her, even though she was a character whom I really like.
Yeah, don't hate me, listeners, but I feel the same way. For me, that's kind of a writing fail in the sense that I can understand Max. I understand what it's like to be really obsessed with a sport, to want to do well. But in terms of the writing, she wasn't given enough outside of that. We weren't able to really engage with her. So she always came off as kind of immature. And later in this season, we'll see it become like vacillation and like, I'm doing this, now I'm not doing this, now I'm doing it again. It kind of gets muddy. And so I think that's kind of unfortunate. And in this episode, we see a major point between Max and Clance, where Max fails her tryout and she wants to go to Clance and she wants to tell Clance about it. And Clance is basically like, my husband's about to leave for war. I could never see him again. And you're going to come tell me you failed your baseball tryout. You have forgotten my life because yours is the only thing that matters.
Yeah, that really stood out to me because obviously in a friendship, it's give and take. It shouldn't be all about Clance or all about Max, but this seemed like one of those times that's so obvious that you should be supporting your friend because she's about to go through something extremely serious. I mean, could you imagine ever doing that to someone?
Emma, this is mortifying, but yes, because I did it. I am Max, and maybe that's why I am not connecting with Max, but yeah, I stayed friends with an ex, and then my new girlfriend broke up with me, and I called my ex, and I was probably about as far into it as Max got before my ex said, Karen, it's my birthday.
No.
Yeah, and the thing was, she had always wanted to get back together with me, and here I was calling on her birthday to complain that my new girlfriend had broken up with me. So I understand that. It's not that part that I don't understand. It's kind of the other stuff.
Something else about Max in this episode that when I rewatched it, I felt sort of disappointed about was that she has the dream to play baseball. They're at this dinner with Clance, her husband, Max, her date. It really bothered me when I watched it again was when Gary says he's gotten the job as the pitcher, the spot. And Max gets so angry and she is like, that was my dream. And Gary was like, well, what was I supposed to do? That was my dream. I think that we're supposed to empathize with Max, but I really felt like this was Max digging herself further into a hole, that she's forgotten that her best friend is about to potentially lose her spouse in war. I mean, realistically, like what was Gary supposed to do when he got this opportunity? It felt to me like it was Max being pretty selfish. And I think kind of like with the portrayal of Shirley being a little bit one note and having her see some ugly and unflattering characteristics, I think with Max portraying her that way, there's a little bit of a danger in that.
To frame that scene in another way, as the audience, we've been told that Max is immature and that she's basically got a one-track mind, is getting on that team. So we do, again, we understand her motivation. But on the other hand, as you say, Gary has a dream too. But more importantly, his dream isn't just baseball, because his dream is here's this beautiful woman, Max, and he's interested in building a life with her. As they go out into the street, he says, "We could be like Clance and her husband." In a very real sense, Max is using him very blatantly. She's just using him. She has no interest in him. So as a character, we have someone who, in this episode, has been a terrible friend. She is selfish. She is using this guy. From a writer's perspective, they needed the save the cat moment. And this is a direct reference to the book that I was talking about, the screenwriting book, which says you have to have a moment where the audience connects with your character. They do something that shows empathy. Max, she doesn't have per se that moment. She doesn't have to save a cat or give her lunch to a starving orphan. But we do have a problem where in this episode, Max really does toe the line into an unlikable character.
Yeah, because earlier in the show, it's asked by other characters like, "Oh, Max, are you just using this guy? Like, are you just trying to get something from this relationship?" And she says no, and she kind of plays it off. But I felt like this started to go a little bit too far. Like, it was one thing to just be flirting with him, talking to him. But I mean, now she's having him out on a date and then getting mad at him for taking advantage of a good opportunity for him. Because yeah, if you put yourself in his shoes, how would you feel if you were really into someone and then you find out that they actually are only trying to get something from you? And that when you get something exciting that you've been hoping for, they're mad at you about it. That was just, I felt like a misplaced anger. I understand why she felt that way. But again, when I rewatched it, I just thought that this was kind of an ugly moment for a character who I really like and I really want to like more.
And to round out the idea of Max as a character in this episode, she flubs her tryout. The whole thing that she said over and over again is, "I'm better than you. I'm better than you. I'm the best there is. I'm so good." And then she goes to throw the ball and it's everywhere. One thing that it did make me wonder about, though, is sometimes these characters really exist in a weird isolation. We have Max out in the street just throwing the ball with her dad, Edgar. And we know that Gary knows she's a good pitcher. I'm like, how did only these two men see her pitch? Shouldn't the whole Black community in this area know she's a good pitcher? When she shows up at the Screw Factory, shouldn't the Black team members stand up and say, "You know what, Max is really good"? It's something that I wonder about.
And this is something that we'll talk about in future podcast episodes. On one hand, it seems like the community is very, very small, that people are all going to the same church and they're very involved. But on the other hand, there are times when it's like, oh, we don't know anything about this person. I want to circle back for a moment in terms of referencing Christianity and the church, and again, going to Shirley. In this episode, we see Carson and Greta, of course, at the convent together. And we know that Max's family is part of a big church, that this is important in their lives, that she was having the relationship with the pastor's wife. Something that I find a little weird overall is that Christianity is kind of mentioned just as something that exists, or it's something that's referenced a little bit fleetingly for jokes or just part of the community. But there isn't, again, that exploration of how a lot of Christian norms contribute to homophobia that exists in society and culture. No one seems to talk about, like, this is sinful to be having a gay relationship, which a lot of churches, that's what they preach. Again, that's something that was weird to me, because I think you're not really going to find mainstream Jewish groups that that's their main message, or that that's something that they're super concerned about. But it really is a dominant thing in society, being driven by certain very powerful and big Christian sects. And so just having them referencing Christianity, but not really exploring that, I thought was something that was kind of strange.
Now that you mention it, because I hadn't thought of it before, but we have these scenes at the revival, but they're just kind of scenes, because they don't, it's like, oh, Black people go to revivals. It doesn't actually drive the story that much farther, other than when Tony talks about how God let her pursue her dream. In terms of the setup of Max's story, one of the things that she could have been fighting against could have been a preacher who was constantly urging the congregation to follow the straight and narrow. There could have been a lot more church pressure there. And I want to just say one final thing as we talk about the characterization of Max and how this episode made it difficult to like her. I hate that the episode ends with Max blackmailing Carson. I really don't think it had to be blackmail.
I love when they come together, and I love seeing them have a relationship. But because this isn't supposed to be a historical period piece, I felt like they could have taken it in a different direction of why Carson and Max end up forming a friendship or why they build a relationship. Because again, we're not watching this to see, oh, this is exactly race relations in the 1940s.
Well, but also Max could have shown up and said, hey, will you throw around a ball with me? The fact that she tries to leverage this blackmail, you just talked about how often we don't see homophobia, okay, a little bit from Shirley. It's like sprinkled in at weird parts. And this is a part where Max is trying to leverage homophobia against Carson, which is a bad foot to start off on. That just, they didn't have to.
Yeah, for a lot of reasons, especially because, again, Carson is married. I hate to say this, but kind of going back to the episode where Max was trying to get the factory job and the white women who worked there blew her off. Realistically, because of social standing at this time, Carson could have just blown Max off. Who's going to believe Max over a married white woman? I mean, that was just the truth of the era.
And who is Max going to even go to?
Yeah, like who does Max know who she's going to say something to and who will care to listen to her?
Yeah, so let's move on. Emma, I think you have some historical tidbits for us, don't you?
I do. I wanted to talk a little bit about something that's mentioned in this episode where Max gets so excited about her $25 paycheck. Because when I saw that, I was like, well, what does that mean? How much is $25 in the 1940s? So the equivalent in today's dollars is about $430, 1943 dollars to today. That's Max's weekly paycheck. However, that doesn't take into account inflation. That doesn't take into account buying power. I wanted to pull up what the prices of some things were during this era. So in the 1940s, the price of milk, do you have any guess how much a gallon of milk would be?
50 cents.
You know, in 1940, it was about 52 cents per gallon.
I might be psychic, Emma. Should I go with some lottery tickets?
By 1945, it was about 63 cents per gallon. And the reason that this is relevant is because I think, as we've talked about before, there was a lot of inflation during this period, during the war. So, Karen, I want to read a little excerpt from the Bulletin of the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics about food prices in 1942 and 1943. So according to this, during 1942, despite record crop production, retail costs of foods advanced steadily at the rate of approximately 1.3% per month, with the greatest increase occurring between December 1941 and January 1942, the first month after U.S. entry into World War II. Food costs at retail averaged 17.4% above the 1941 level, and 30.1% above the 1939 level. So understanding there was a big hike in food prices, kind of like in our current era, people were really feeling the pinch. And so for Max and then Clance to get jobs at the factory where they'd be making more, it was a really big deal in terms of how much they could spend and how much they could afford things. And as we discussed in an earlier episode, we also know that it's extremely likely that the wages for Black workers were lower than for their white counterparts.
Yeah, this was really the first time women turned out in huge numbers into the workforce. And you've said it before, and it's just so true. It was seismic shifts in this societal dynamic. If you could leave the home and make your own money, you could control more of the purchasing. It really changed the role of women in the household. And even when men came back and started rejoining factory work, a lot of that persisted. And you know, you talked about, I think it was episode 2, pants, right? Women being able to wear pants for the first time.
Yeah, I think that drives home how excited Max must have been when she is at Tony's home and Tony gives her an attitude about the eggs and serving her breakfast. And then Max can put down, like, here's money for rent, here's money for food. That's going to be a big deal with bringing in more income, because even if Tony is successful, it still is a big jump in what Max is making. And then for Clance entering that type of work too, because she mentions that she's worried that when her husband is away, they could lose the home without his tips. I really think something with the Clance storyline is that it speaks to financial freedom for women. And we see this too with the Peaches making money and their checks that they're so excited about. It's a really big deal at this time because so many women didn't work outside the home. You know, for people to have their own money that they can spend as they want, that they can spend to support their family at a time when that wasn't the norm. I think I want to launch into our closing segment today, which is three lightning round questions. So the first one would be, what's something we have not discussed yet that you would change about this episode?
One of the things about this episode was there's a little bit of disjointedness. Part of this, maybe when you shoot something, a movie, a TV show, there's something called blocking. So let's say you're going to shoot the Peaches on a bus and you're going to shoot bus scenes in three different episodes. Well, to use that set scene, maybe you'll shoot all of those scenes in a week and you'll just have people change clothing and then those scenes will get spliced in at the appropriate time. But what results is you have to make sure that everyone has kind of the appropriate emotions for that scene. And I think there were a few slips in this episode.
So you mean things that are kind of like a little bit of a plot hole or a little bit of the tone isn't quite right?
Yeah, we might think of it as a tone discontinuity. So for example, something that stood out to me is the Peaches are on the bus. When we finished episode 3, Carson throws a baseball at Dove and basically is trying to get him back in line.
Let me just say, I forgot that Dove was still here in this episode.
Yeah, and he should be in some ways angry at Carson for calling him out and all this stuff. And of course, Lupe was angry because she'd been sidelined because Carson pointed out that she was hurt and all that. But all of a sudden on the bus, Dove is committed to protecting Lupe's arm. Lupe and Carson are friendly. Dove is interested in Carson's notes. There's just that little moment of discontinuity there.
Yeah, when I was watching, I didn't quite know, again, like, what was Dove doing? Because we've seen him be not interested in the team. He's just looking out for himself. And I didn't feel like we got an answer. So yeah, what you're saying, that was just kind of a strange scene on the bus.
And then the other thing, it's not per se a discontinuity, but sometimes you and I talk about backstory questions. We have Max and her father, Edgar, and she's throwing him the ball. He's catching. There's kind of a gap here because there's this presumption that he taught her to play baseball, but was he a really good player? What is his role here? What does he know? And if not him, who taught her? You know, things like this, that there's sort of an implied thing, but there's a gap that just feels a little weird to me.
Yeah, it would have been nice if we knew more about where Max got her love of the game. And I'd say a lot of the characters, like, where did this love of the game come from? Speaking of characters, the next thing I want to ask you would be, we've talked about how we think the acting is really good. There's really some great performances here. Was there anything acting-wise that you'd be like, that didn't quite land for me?
Okay, listeners, don't get angry, but something that kind of drives me a little nuts is Esty Gonzalez is supposed to be the fastest runner on the team, right? They say it over and over again. But the actress, Priscilla Delgado, is a terrible runner. I'm so sorry, but she's a terrible runner. She might be the actually worst runner on the entire cast.
What? Okay, what makes you say that?
Because this whole episode, the Peaches, they're stealing bases, and she's the base stealer. And so she's supposed to be running, and the camera's following her as her arms flail, her limbs flail. And I just think that in casting the role, it's not a huge role. She's one of those kind of background people. And I just wish they'd cast someone who could run or used a body double who could run.
Of course, the show isn't about solely on baseball. It isn't solely about the athleticism. But I see what you mean about, for a character like that, who they talk so much about her athletic prowess, they maybe could have given her at least a little more training on how to kind of sell that storyline.
Or just use body doubles. But that character, since it's so integral to the character, for me, that was just a miscast.
So the last question I'm going to ask would be, who was your favorite Peach of this episode?
Okay, I'm going to come out of left field. A sports metaphor. and say Terry. And if that name doesn't ring a bell, it's because this character doesn't often get named. Terry is the relief pitcher. The actress is Ray Gray. And the reason I choose Terry is because when they've set up the roles of each of these characters, not on the team, but in terms of what they bring to the story, right? Shirley is the comedic relief who also brings in that flavor of homophobia. Joe is the slugger, but who also is Greta's best friend and is the catalyst for some of Greta's growth. But Terry is kind of the one who's there for like also comedic relief, but also she's like this plug and play character who, okay, she'll pitch while Lupe sits out so she can be the catalyst to that storyline. Or they're walking into the convent and she asks Carson, why are you so happy? And it sets up that joke. So I think that we should recognize Terry as this character who is in all of the background scenes, but really doesn't get the chance to speak much. And so when she does, we know that she's got some sort of contribution to the plot or a joke.
I think that's a really good pick. And something that we've talked about before would be getting to explore more of that ensemble. There's characters like Terry who pop in every once in a while, or people you see in the background and you're like, oh, who's that? Or were you there last week? Were you there in the last episode?
Oh my God, Emma. It was only this episode that I started to wonder if we're actually being punked. That's an old reference. If any of our viewers are younger than us, they might not get it. Okay, so what that means is, is there a running gag where every time we see the Peaches, there's some new member and the crew is just trying to see if we notice? Because I swear to God, in this episode, there were two players I'd never seen before. And one in particular was in a lot of the scenes. She had blonde hair in braids. And I was just like, who are you? And what is your position on the Peaches?
It would be nice if they had released a more thorough roster that we could have looked at.
For sure. And also props to all of these unnamed Peaches who forever in our hearts, but their names gone from history.
It's true. They're the unsung heroes. I mean, this is a team sport. Teamwork makes the dream work.
It does. Okay, as we wrap this up, Emma, final thoughts.
I'm excited to discuss the next episode. I think that a lot has happened now that I think about Carson's progression. I'm really hoping to see Max do more character growth. I'm excited to see the arcs of people around them. I think we're going to have a really good discussion moving forward. And I'm glad that we got to explore some things today that are outside the show, but more about the context around it.
Do you want to sing us out, as it were?
How about I just give us the closing? Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is Peaches Aren't the Only Fruit Podcast. You can find us at PATOF Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. Please send us a message. We love to hear from fans. We really appreciate feedback. Karen, you can find at Lez_Dish. That's LEZ_Dish on social media. I'm Emma. You can find me at Late Less Ordinary on numerous platforms.
Thanks for listening, guys, and we will talk to you next time.